So I will say Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
As always, we ready to jump in?
Jumping in.
Might as well. Both feet, right?
Yeah.
Last week we ended with, of course, discussing this connection between the symbols of the tribes of Israel and how those tribes were arranged by division. We saw a pretty precise pecking order. He was very, very direct about how he wanted those tribes surrounding the tabernacle. God organized all that for a purpose. There were four divisions. There were three tribes in each one, and each one had a leader tribe, right? And each leader tribe had a symbol. And each one of those divisions had a specific directional location, east, northwest, east, south, around the tabernacle. And we saw those symbols being, of course, a lion, a bull, an eagle, and a man. And when we examined Ezekiel and Revelation, we saw living beings around that heavenly throne that had the same four faces as those symbols, and also facing those same directions, which is really cool. So we understand then that the reason that Yehovah had them camp the way that they did was to give us a vision of the kingdom of God. And we began to understand that these living beings with all of these eyes, I mean, I made the comment, you know, we saw how many people there were, you know, in each one of those divisions. Well, how many eyes were there in those divisions? So, you know, that really spoke to me that's God's vision, right? I mean, it's a picture of the spiritual throne and his dwelling place, but yet what's the desire of his heart? To have his family around him. It just, I don't know, it just does the heart good. And we see then that we have this pattern that is given to us over and over of this throne room. He wants us to have that same vision, I think. That spiritual Israel, you and me, are represented in those visions, in those living creatures. We are those living creatures. And he desires us to have us around him. It's pretty amazing, really, when you think about all that God has done. And, you know, last night we were looking at a thing, and I'm going off on a tangent, but we were looking at this thing last night. Many years ago, I gave a message, I think it was entitled, it's not on the website, it's a long time ago, this is something to do with letting God show off. And so the whole message was just all about how the expanse of the universe and how big God is and how orderly everything is, and then even coming down into the small, everything, you know, there's just, I can't go there, there's just too much. But just this idea of just how big God is, you know, there's more stars. If you take every grain of sand on the planet times 10,000, that's an estimate of how many stars there are. And he knows every one of them by name and sets them in place, and yet he cares about me. And he wants me and you around his dwelling place. So we see all of this, we see all of these visions, and we get this. I keep talking about the reality of duality, right? Okay, every spiritual principle he is replicating in a physical earthly counterpart, and vice versa. And so as we move into chapter 25, which we're finally going to do today, we're going to see more of that. And the entire chapter of 25, except for maybe a couple, I think maybe the intro verse, is all the words of Yehovah. So traditionally I've been reading those, but I didn't want to take the time to read the whole chapter to you. So that's why I ask everybody to read it ahead of time. Just familiarize yourself with it. So as we start to do this, I can just reference things as we go along. But I want to start by highlighting the very first thing that he said. In verse 2, he said, "Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering." Now, the next seven verses then describe all these raw materials that he wants collected from the people in order to make the tabernacle, to make all the associated items. We're going to read about all the gold and the silver and the bronze that were used to make the tabernacle. And we'll get into those in more precise detail later in Exodus. But for right now, what I want to share with you is the total weight, the estimated total weight of these metals approached 8 tons. 8 tons. Now, where did they get this huge quantity of these precious metals? They're out in the middle of nowhere. I've been there. There ain't nothing but rocks and a few occasional trees. Right? So where did they get all this? Well, of course, they brought it from Egypt. When they plundered the Egyptians, God instructed them to ask of the Egyptians for these things, and of course they gave it to them and gladly get out of here, right? They wanted them gone. So that we don't have any skepticism going forward, let's get an idea of just how easy it was for them to come up with this, right? We've talked at length about how many people there was. There's probably around 3 million people, okay? Basically the population of Los Angeles. So it would have taken less than 1/12 of 1 ounce per person to have 8 tons of metals dragged out of there. So it was more than doable, okay? This was not, every single person would have had multiple times that, right? Okay. So I just wanted to clear that up because some people have questioned that. Well, where did they get all this stuff? And that's too much. And you know, surely they didn't drag 8 tons of stuff out of, well, yeah, they did. I mean, many hands make the load lighter, right? Okay. In verse 1, in this verse here, God tells Moses that he wants to collect these materials. But he says very plainly that he only wants stuff from those who are willing to give it without any coercion. This is to be an offering. It's to be a contribution. Nothing was to be given for any other reason than the person wants to give it. And I think it's very interesting what isn't here, and that is there is no penalty for not giving. You notice that? In many times in God's law and his requirements, there is a consequence for not adhering to that, whether it's a direct consequence of him instituting a penalty or whether it's just a natural consequence, right? There's usually a consequence, but not here. Why? Because this is not a command. It's not a command. And so it seems that there was not to be any peer pressure or guilt applied to the people in order to get them to give. We don't read about any grand speech or sermon by Moses, or any instructions by Yehovah as to what to tell the people. simply the need is stated, and then the giving is either from the people's heart or not at all. Now, you have to think about what they had all just been through. You know, they're just fresh out of Egypt, so they have a lot of these things on their mind. He's up there thundering. So, you know, probably it wasn't real hard for people to respond, right? So probably everybody contributed to one level or another. But again, it didn't take much. I mean, it might have been just an earring. See what I mean? Okay. It's important to note that in Hebrew thinking, there is more than one kind of offering. This particular kind is what's called in Hebrew a terumah, and it's sometimes referred to as a heave offering. And it's talked about that way because of it's very descriptive of the way traditionally it was given or offered up to God, because the priests would literally take whatever it is and heave it over their shoulders to God as an offering, and then, you know, place it in the storehouse. So that's kind of why it's called that. But this terumah carries a sense of, again, a contribution, but it's the giver contributing to a need, okay? So this kind of offering, this terumah, was not a sacrifice. And certainly not in the way that other things were given. You see, sacrifices were required, right? These were required actions in order to either atone for a violation of the law or complete some sort of celebration or covenant ritual. But most of the sacrifices were burned up. Well, these certainly weren't, right? I mean, they were utilized. So sacrifices required the giving of an animal or wine or, you know, money or grain or what have you, and usually in a prescribed amount and certain things for particular sacrifices. This is not that. The terumah carries the element of free will and heart, just like it says. So I suppose I could go down a long rabbi trail here and talk about giving and tithing and that kind of thing, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say this. I think we need to remember that there are attempts by some church authorities to characterize our giving, our tithing, as some sort of New Testament version of the Old Testament sacrificial system. Okay? And that's just not right. That's just wrong. Yeshua has already satisfied every requirement of the sacrificial system, every part of it. He has once and for all. And so our giving, our tithing, should not be classified as a sacrifice. The God principle here is that our giving is set down for us right here in this verse, okay? It's equivalent to a free will offering, a heave offering, a terumah. We support the efforts of our collective church body through tithing, but we do it with a joyful heart, freely, out of a giving attitude and out of gratitude for what Yeshua has done, and that he has completed and fulfilled that sacrificial system. Okay, so we should not look at it that way at all. We look at it and know that it's God's heart to bless us, right? It's why he says this here in Malachi. We've read this before. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this. Test me. says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there won't be room enough to receive it. So basically what Yehovah says is, give to me freely and watch what I do with it. You keep that 10%, man, what are you going to do with it? Right? You're probably going to waste it on something, right? And whatever you waste it on is going to, the moth and rust and everything else is going to destroy it anyway. Give it to me and watch what I do with it. Okay? Because I'm going to pour out a blessing with it so much you ain't even going to be able to hang on to it. Okay? So we give freely. Yeshua gives back freely. And when he gives freely, he's giving from a storehouse that much bigger than ours. So really, in fact, we talk about it all the time. All of it is his, isn't it? Everything flows from him. It's all his. And he lets us keep 90, he lets us be steward over 90% of it. All right, enough said about that. Let's move on. The tabernacle. I had you guys read some of this stuff, but I found this little video, and it gives a visual, kind of a visual representation to help visualize and really think about what this looked like. So I'm going to play this now, and then once it's done, I'll come back and continue.
Tell the sons of Israel to raise a contribution for me. From every man whose heart moves him, you shall raise my contribution. And let them construct a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell among them. According to all that I am going to show you, as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all the furniture, just so you shall construct it.
After the parting of the Red Sea, it would seem that the Hebrew people would have eagerly obeyed everything that God asked them to do. But their investigation of the land God had promised them caused them to fear for their lives again. Yet this time, they did not give God the opportunity to show how he could deliver them. Instead, they chose their own way. Sadly, the result of this disobedience was to be forced to wander in the desert wilderness for 40 years. Their disbelief in God's ability to deliver them became a sentence of sorts, representing 1 year for each day they had spent spying out the land. Further, none of those who were 20 years of age or older would ever see the promised land. Yet, this nomadic lifestyle and the loss of the former promise did not mean that God had abandoned them. He had promised to dwell among them. So he commanded Moses to build a house of sorts. This dwelling place was for the God of a people who now lived in tents. This house was known as the tabernacle. At night, the presence of God would appear as a pillar of fire to direct them and protect them. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day when it was taken up. For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was fire in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel.
The sons of Israel shall camp, each by his own standard, with the banners of their fathers' households. They shall camp around the tent of meeting at a distance. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be of the standard of the camp of Judah by their armies. And those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Issachar. Then comes the tribe of Zebulun. On the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben by their armies. And those who camp next to him shall be the tribe of Simeon. Then comes the tribe of Gad. Then the tent of meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps, just as they camp. So they shall set out, every man in his place, by their standards. On the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim by their armies. And next to him shall be the tribe of Manasseh. Then comes the tribe of Benjamin. On the north side shall be the standard of the camp of Dan by their armies. And those that camp next to him shall be the tribe of Asher. Then comes the tribe of Naphtali.
These are the numbered men of the sons of Israel by their fathers' households. The total of the numbered men of the camps by their armies, 603,550. The Levites, however, were not numbered among the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus, the sons of Israel did, according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So they camped by their standards, and so they set out, everyone by his family, according to his father's household. God is holy. Nothing unclean or anyone with sin can exist in the presence of God. So a separation was created to keep the sin of the people apart from the holiness of God. This outer curtain was the beginning of that separation. No one harboring sin could pass through it, and the sole purpose in going beyond its borders was to seek atonement or the forgiveness of sins. And he erected the court all around the tabernacle and the altar, and hung up the veil for the gateway of the court. Thus Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Man cannot survive in God's presence unless he is invited and is completely pure. And so even Moses, the man of God, had to wait until the cloud lifted before he could even enter the tabernacle. Entering into the courtyard, we come to the place where the first step in meeting with God was taken.
Build an altar of acacia wood, 3 cubits high. It is to be square, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. Make a horn at each of the 4 corners, so that the horns and the altar are of one piece, and overlay the altar with bronze. Make poles of acacia wood for the altar, and overlay them with bronze. The poles are to be inserted into the rings, so that they will be on the 2 sides of the altar when it is carried.
God required daily sacrifices to be made, continually confirming the covenant between himself and the people. These sacrifices and offerings would be
a pleasing aroma, an offering made to the Lord by fire. For generations to come, this burnt offering is to be made regularly at the entrance to the tent of meeting before the Lord. There I will meet with you and speak to you. There also I will meet with the Israelites, and the place will be consecrated by my glory.
Next, we see a large basin of water placed strategically between the brazen altar and the tent of meeting. The laver was a vessel of physical and symbolic cleansing for the priests in their service before the Lord. It was absolutely essential that they were to be clean before beginning the process of meeting with their holy God.
Make a bronze basin, with it a bronze stand for washing. Place it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and put water in it. Aaron and his sons are to wash their hands and feet with the water from it. Whenever they enter the tent of meeting, they shall wash with water, so that they will not die. Also, when they approach the altar to minister by presenting an offering made to the Lord by fire, they shall wash their hands and feet so that they will not die. This is to be a lasting ordinance for Aaron and his descendants for the generations to come.
Once again, we come to a place of further separation and increasing holiness, for only the priests would enter into the tent of meeting.
For the entrance to the tent, make a curtain of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and finely twisted linen, the work of an embroiderer. And shaft. Its flower-like cups, buds, and blossoms shall be of one piece with it. Six branches are to extend from the sides of the lampstand, three on one side, three on the other. Then make it seven lamps and set them upon it so that they light the space in front of it. Its wick trimmers and trays are to be of pure gold. A talent of pure gold is to be used for the lampstand and all its accessories. See that you make them according to the pattern shown you on the mountain.
Closed off from the outside world, the single source of light for the holy place came from the seven lamps atop the golden lampstand. The combined light of these oil lamps would reflect well off the walls, since they were covered completely with gold. The ambient glow of the lampstand would illumine across the room to the table of showbread. On this table were kept 12 loaves of fresh bread, one for each tribe, as a continual reminder of man's need for God's provision. This offering of bread was called the bread of presence, since it was kept before God's presence.
Make a table of acacia wood 2 cubits long, 1 cubit wide, and 1.5 cubits high. Overlay it with pure gold, and make a gold molding around it. Also make around it a rim 1 handbreadth wide, and put a gold molding on the rim. Make 4 gold rings for the table, and fasten them to the 4 corners, where the 4 legs are. The rings are to be close to the rim to hold the poles used in carrying the table. Make the poles of acacia wood, overlay them with gold, and carry the table with them. And make its plates and dishes of pure gold, as well as its pitchers and bowls for the pouring out of offerings. Put the bread of presence on this table to be before me at all times.
Since the desert was not a source of abundant food, God provided all the food the Israelites needed to sustain them. The table of showbread, then, represented an offering to God. they would give an offering of their first fruits from the abundance that he had provided. It was a thanks offering, expressing gratitude for God's abundant blessings. The altar of incense represented the need for the prayers of the people to be continuously directed upwards toward God, and that those same prayers would be received by God as a sweet aroma and be pleasing to his ear.
Make an altar of acacia wood for burning incense. It is to be square, a cubit long and a cubit wide, and 2 cubits high, its horns of one piece with it. Overlay the top and all the sides and the horns with pure gold, and make a gold molding around it. Make 2 gold rings for the altar below the molding, 2 on opposite sides, to hold the poles used to carry it. Make the poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold.
Just beyond the altar of incense was the Holy of Holies. This dwelling place of God was so solemn and set apart that the veil would only be opened once a year. It was then that the high priest would meet with God. Pushing back the veil reveals the article above which this most holy meeting would occur: the Ark of the Covenant.
Have them make a chest of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. Overlay it with pure gold, both inside and out, and make a gold molding around it. Cast 4 gold rings for it, and fasten them to its 4 feet, with 2 rings on one side and 2 rings on the other. Then make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. Insert the poles into the rings on the sides of the chest to carry it. Make an atonement cover of pure gold, 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. And make 2 cherubim out of hammered gold at the ends of the cover. Make 1 cherub on one end and the 2nd cherub on the other. Make the cherubim of 1 piece with the cover at the 2 ends. The cherubim are to have their wings spread upward, overshadowing the cover with them. The cherubim are to face each other, looking toward the cover. Place the cover on top of the ark, and put in the ark the testimony, which I will give you. There, above the cover, between the 2 cherubim that are over the ark of the testimony, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites.
Stored inside the ark were 3 very important reminders of the people's relationship with God. Each one reminded the Israelites of having learned a specific lesson from God. The value in keeping these 3 items was to build a remembrance of God's provision and direction for his children. Since the desert could not produce enough food for all the people, God provided a special food for them every morning, manna. 6 days of every week, they collected this heaven-sent food. The Israelites had received this manna faithfully each morning for 40 years. As an enduring testimony, a golden pot filled with manna was kept inside the ark. Inside the golden pot was an omer's worth of manna, or 1 day's portion. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so that they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt. Then place it before the Lord, to be kept for the generations to come. As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony, that it might be kept. The difficulties of life in the desert became a heavy toll for many of the Israelites. They even revolted against the leaders God had chosen for them. Yet, God proved to them that He had chosen their leader. The sign for this was Aaron's rod that had miraculously budded, flowered, and bore almonds all in one night. This was their reminder to not complain against the Lord's chosen.
Speak to the Israelites and get 12 staffs from them, one from the leader of each of their ancestral tribes. Write the name of each man on his staff. On the staff of Levi, write Aaron's name, for there must be one staff for the head of each ancestral tribe. Place them in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony, where I meet with you. The staff belonging to the man I choose will sprout, and I will rid myself of this constant grumbling against you by the Israelites.
The next day, Moses entered the tent of the testimony and saw that Aaron's staff, which represented the house of Levi, had not only sprouted, but had budded, blossomed, and produced almonds. The Lord said to Moses,
Put back Aaron's staff in front of the testimony, to be kept as a sign to the rebellious. This will put an end to their grumbling against me, so that they will not die.
The best known of the reminders kept inside the ark were the two stone tablets engraved with the Ten Commandments. These tablets contained the primary rules they were to live by, which would protect and govern them. God would also use these to examine their faithfulness and commitment to following Him.
Chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets.
So Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones, and went up to Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him. And he carried the two stone tablets in his hands. It is here, just above the cover to the Ark of the Covenant, also known as the Mercy Seat, here in this space where the cherubim, the guardians of God, have set their full attention, that God's presence would appear to and meet with the high priest on a specified day, and then only once a year. The Holy of Holies had no lampstand, no artificial light was permitted. Here in this place, where the immortal God would meet with mortal man, the only light came from the powerful purity found in the presence of God.
Well, I thought that was well done, and it would give some depth these details. Hopefully it was worthwhile. It's funny, as I watched it, I got to the part about when they were putting the manna in there, and it just got me thinking about food, you know, with my health issues. I'm changing everything about how I'm eating and all of that, and I was starting to get a little jealous of the Israelites, you know, because it's a hassle, you know. I mean, here they have, you know, this food that was delivered to them every morning, and it was 100% nutritious. You know, everything you needed in that thing. You know, they didn't have to worry about pesticides or genetically modified grain or processed sugars or anything. Just eat it, and it's everything you need. I mean, think about it. It sustained them for 40 years in perfect health. No cancer, no health problems, no nothing. They had everything that they needed, you know? Because I was talking to somebody about it, you know, a month or two ago. I was like, man, I wish there was just one perfect food, you know, you could just eat it. And they had it, you know? And then I thought about the name manna, and I had to chuckle to myself. I had this little kind of thing go through my head. I know I'm going on a tangent here, but do you guys know what manna? Okay, so I thought about that old Abbott and Costello routine, you know? The who's on first thing, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know, on third. And then I just had this whole, like, thing in my head about, because manna literally means, what is it? And so I just kind of thought about this conversation, you know, the Israelites go out there and go, what is this? And God says, yeah. No, really, what's it called? You know, what is it? Yeah, you're right, that's it, you know. And I mean, just back and forth, and you know, I know it didn't happen, but it made me chuckle. Anyway. He does have a sense of humor. You don't think he has a sense of humor. Look at some of the animals he's made. I mean, we watched a show on TV a while back on Discovery of the birds. If you guys have never seen that, it's hilarious how these birds do these dances and all these things to attract their mates. Anyway, we're off on a tangent. But he definitely has a sense of humor. Let's see, where am I at? Let's get back to our subject at hand. I do hope that gave, you know, just a little bit better than that piece of plastic that I, you know, put together that I have up here. Okay, so there is a lot of meaning in these details. We're gonna drive into some of these, but the first thing I want to do is kind of back out, because there's kind of an interesting thing if you look at the overall picture. When we look at Exodus 25, what do we have? From verses 1 to 9, we have him talking about what to be collected, how to collect it from the heart. Then he moves to the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, then the table of showbread, and then the golden lampstand, and then we get into chapter 26, and he begins the details of how to build the tabernacle itself, the outer court, and how to build the tent of meeting and all of that. Okay, and so what's interesting is that before we're given the construction details of the tabernacle building, we get these instructions first. The sacred items, the holy items, we get those first. And so what we find is that he begins with the holiest thing first, the ark, where his presence is going to be. And then he goes to the next holy things right outside the veil, and he talks about those. And then only then does he go outside of the tent of meetings to the place where humanity is embraced out there, right? And so what we see is that he begins from the inside and he works outward. It's a different, I don't know, it just kind of struck me, right? We build a house first and then we fill it, right? Well, he didn't do that. He started with the inner man. With the inner holiness first, and then came out from there. And so what we see is that holiness proceeds outward, right, from Yehovah, even in the way that he revealed these things. So we can't make anything holy. You know, we say that all the time about the Sabbath. You know, you keep the Sabbath holy. We can't make anything holy. We can just keep it holy. We don't bring anything holy to the party. We only can come into his holiness. So anyway, I wanted to make that point. And then I also want to highlight verse 9 here, where it says, according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all of its furnishings, just so you shall make it. Now, we've talked about this a bit. This was Yehovah talking to Moses during his 40 days on the mountain, all right? And Moses at this point had not come back down to the people yet. And many verses will translate this verse as making it according to the pattern I show you. That's fine. But the question is, what is the pattern? What's the pattern? When he was up there, did Yehovah just roll out a scroll or a papyrus or whatever and show him what he wanted to make? Now, this is personal. I don't think that's what he did. I think that Yehovah gave Moses a vision of the spiritual throne room. Just like he did with John, just like he did with Ezekiel and other, he gave Moses this vision. I think he spread out the veil so that Moses could see the pattern of the things that I make it after the things that I showed you, right? So, I mean, I can't prove that. That's my own personal thing, but do remember that tabernacle in Hebrew is Mishkan, M-I-S-H-K-A-N, and it literally means dwelling place. And so Moses was to build this wilderness tabernacle along the lines, I think, of the vision that he gave to Moses of his throne room, his dwelling place, right, in heaven, the spiritual realm. And so Moses' vision of the spirit realm, the spiritual tabernacle, was to be transformed into this working model for physical Israel. It was a copy, but it was developed based on the reality of the spirit realm. Now, I know I've made a big deal about this point. I've mentioned it several times. And so I thought, well, do people just think this is, you know, my, like an allegory or something that I've kind of made up or a theory on my part? But it's not. There's evidence of this, okay? In Hebrews chapter 8, Paul is expounding on how the priesthood, right, has changed from having a physical high priest over to Yeshua and all of that, and that a temporary physical high priest has been replaced by a permanent spiritual high priest. Okay, so in speaking about that physical priesthood, he said this. He said, for if he, Yeshua, were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown to you on the mountain. What was the pattern? The pattern was the shadow of the heavenly things. Okay, so I'm not out on a limb here, right? You can read more about all of that later in the rest of Hebrews 8 and chapter 9. Spends a lot of time talking about those comparisons between the earthly and the heavenly, using the tabernacle, using the sacrificial system to make that point. And these same chapters also point out a principle that can be easily flip-flopped or even completely missed, really. And that is that the physical is inferior to the spiritual. That what exists in the spirit world is far greater, far superior in its capabilities and purity than what is even possible in the physical realm. For instance, the tabernacle and all of those services are real, right? And they were God ordained, but they were just copies, inferior copies of the real original spiritual tabernacle that existed simultaneously. Okay. So I want to talk about this idea of shadows, because the Bible uses this to compare the earthly to the heavenly. You know, we say it's a shadow of things to come. We see that many times describing elements of the tabernacle and the prophecies, the law, things like that. It's referring to the fact that compared to the spiritual, the physical copy can't match it. You can't get the depth of reality from a shadow. Now, when you see the shadow of something, what do you get? You get the outline, right? But you don't get much detail. So, right? So if the sun's over here and there's a wall here and the sun's shining across and you're coming this way and you see my shadow, well, you know I'm there. But you don't see me. You don't get much, do you? Right? Okay. So that's kind of the way it is, because Yehovah cannot be absorbed by our mind. He's just too much. We can't get it. We can try. He's given us a universe that's so vast we can't wrap our minds around it, just to prove the point that we can't do it. And so it's a very good analogy of a shadow. Because we can see that he's real, we can see that he's there, but we really can't put our eyes on him, right? Okay. It's just like, you just can't compare. I mean, Sherilyn can paint. She can paint beautiful landscapes, for example. But you go to Colorado and you stand at the Continental Divide, and I'm sorry, she can't do it justice, right? Nobody can. And that, you can't get the fullness of it. And that is the difference between this physical world and the shadows that we learn in comparison to the spiritual. And so I wanted to take the time to discuss this, because many have perverted this concept. Some would even use that scripture, to say that, yes, the law is done away. Because it's just, you know, it's just a shadow. It's not, you know, it's not important anymore, right? And that can't be right. Because think about this. If you take away the reality, is the shadow still there? No. Right? So if you say that the shadow is gone, then whatever it was that was casting the shadow is gone. That's doing away with God himself. That's why I always say, if you're going to do away with the law, you're doing away with God. Because the law is a reflective of him. It's a shadow. It's a reflection of who he is. You cannot do away with that and not do away with the source. It's an important concept. Okay, don't buy into that whole, well, it's just a shadow, so it's gone. No, please, don't. All right, I got to hurry along here. Every element of the tabernacle, from its rooms, its materials, its design, furniture, all of that, was patterned off of the heavenly original. And it looked forward to that reality. Okay, so I want to share another connection, this symbolism, showing how God does everything according to this pattern that we're talking about. All right, we know that the Holy of Holies is where he put his presence, right? Okay. Before the tabernacle was built, now the tabernacle's not built yet. These are the instructions. Did God, now the Holy of Holies was where God's presence was going to be. Was his presence somewhere else at this point? Sure. It was on top of the mountain, wasn't it? Okay, follow with me. In chapter 25, Moses is meeting there with him at the top of the mountain. And Yehovah is very consistent about this whole pattern. And so it should be no surprise that the pattern is never deviated from. Think for a moment about how the tabernacle was laid out in the same way that the geographical location of Mount Sinai and what they were doing at this point before they had the tabernacle, they're identical. The pattern is still there. The mountain and the tabernacle both had these three zones, didn't they? You have the Holy of Holies in the tent of meeting. Then you had the inner room, right, where the priests would come. And then you had the outer courtyard. And then you had basically a fence around it. Okay. All of those things continue with this pattern. Because the mountain, you had the top of the mountain where Moses was, where God called Moses up and where his presence was. Nobody else went up there. Then you had the slope of the mountain where after the sacrifice was made and the covenant was put into place and ratified, the 70 elders, Moses, Aaron, and his two sons went up. But they didn't go to the top. They went into the same place where the showbread and everything was, just like the priest did. And then you had a stone fence. They built a stone barrier around the base of Mount Sinai. Okay? Just like the barrier around there. Okay? And it wasn't until Moses built an altar. Where did he build an altar? He built an altar on the inside of that fence. Okay? Just like where was the altar in the wilderness tabernacle in the courtyard. And it was only after that was done that then a representatives of the people could cross the barrier into the slope of the mountain that represented that inner room of the tent of meeting. But nobody but Moses, acting as the high priest at the time, was able to go to the top of the mountain. The pattern was exactly the same. He doesn't deviate from it. He had those two connected rooms. That was the mountain. The top and the bottom. Yeah, the fence. You had and then the people would then be able to come into the courtyard when the altar was built and the sacrifice was made for the atonement of the people, then they could come into the courtyard. Right? And so that was represented by the 70 elders, Moses, Aaron, and his two sons. It's just so cool. And so that whole area, the valley floor, was symbolic of the courtyard. And the barrier around that is his people that then were invited in once the sacrifice and the covenant was made. It's fascinating. And here's another thing that's really fascinating about that. 400 years earlier, Yehovah brought the infant tribe of Israel from Canaan up to Egypt. You guys know the story. There was famine, blah, blah, blah. Joseph took control. He was governor, stored up the grain, blah, blah, blah. And then he met his brothers and revealed himself, and he said, yeah, come on up. So Israel, Jacob, renamed Israel, and his family then moved from Canaan up into Israel. Or up into, into Egypt. I do that all the time. So anyway, they came up there. Right. Do you know how many there were in Jacob's family when they went from Canaan into Egypt?
74.
Who went? And that 74 represented all of Israel. Now, there was more than that that came up, because what happened over the years is, like, there was one time, remember when the king's son raped Dinah, and they went in and they, you know, and they killed all the men, and they took the women and the children, and they brought them back with them. So the camp of Israel was more than 74 people. But there were 74 family members that represented all of Israel that went into Egypt. And now 400 years later, God had how many come up to the mountain and represent all of Israel? 70 elders plus 4, Moses, Aaron, and his two sons, 400 years apart. He had the same number of people representing Israel going into Egypt as he did bringing them out of Egypt and into covenant with himself. It's amazing. It's amazing. So this is why, of course, Moses erected 12 standing stones, 12 monuments at the base of Mount Sinai to represent the 12 tribes before God. And God instructed, you know, we saw that the table of showbread had 12 loaves to represent the 12 tribes. And inside the two separate rooms of the sanctuary, the holy place and the holy of holies, all of the fixtures were made of gold. Everything was overlaid with gold. Gold is a symbol in the Bible of purity and holiness, okay? But you'll notice when we get out into the outer court, there's no gold out there. It's all bronze. It's all bronze and metal and other things, way less valuable metals. Okay, I'm going to mention one more thing, and then we'll... You saw from the video, and you'll see from the scriptures, that the tabernacle didn't contain any images whatsoever of Yehovah. The religion of Yehovah was to be an image-less religion. The second of the Ten Commandments is very clear, not to have any graven images. No images. Why? What are you going to make? I mean, seriously, what are you going to make? We see a shadow. Are you going to make a shadow? What are you going to make? I don't know of any other religion on the face of the earth that doesn't have some sort of imagery, right? But God said, don't do that. The only thing that he gave, the only thing he gave us permission to represent anything about him was the tzitzit. That's it. And what does it represent? The commandments. They represent his law. And doesn't that represent him? You know, if you want something, he said, look to my law, because my law is a reflection of me. The law is if you want to call it a shadow, yeah, I guess. It's a small part of him. But he says, like, if you want to focus on something about me, that's what I want you to focus on. I want you to focus on my character, on what I'm building in terms of my kingdom and how it's going to be operated, right? So this was all image, you know, all of these things that were in there. There was nothing that was an image of God to represent him that they could have, like, worshipped. Okay, so the next step in our journey is to start to look at these individual articles that we read about in chapter 25. The ark, we're going to start with the ark, and we're going to go from there. But we're out of time, and if I started that, we'd we'd be way over. So I'm not going to breach that subject today, and we'll pick up next time on this series with looking at the ark and moving on past then. Sound good?
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and circle up and chew on what we got so far.